And Bobby Sands died in pursuit of a united Ireland. He gave his life literally, I mean, to bring about a united Ireland. And there can be a discussion today in 2022, and indeed there is a discussion, as to whether the settlement which has been reached under the Good Friday Agreement, whether that represents an adequate return on the pain sort of invested, if you like, by Republicans and by the nationalist community generally in Northern Ireland. Is the settlement which is now being put in place and which is operating, is that a fair enough return? And that's a question, of course, which you can't answer yes or no, or certainly we can't answer it yes or no as yet. So again, sort of there's, when we talk about, there's a very fluid situation in Ireland, and particularly in Northern Ireland, and it would be foolish to analyse it in terms of, you know, static positions for and against unification, or for and against retaining Northern Ireland as part of the United Kingdom. In the cliche,
we have 5 seconds, way, Eamon.
Okay, Alicia, it's still all to be played for. Whether we get a final settlement, that was very dubious. Northern Ireland defies logic. And so nobody knows. Literally, I don't know. Nobody else knows how this thing is going to work out.
We'll leave it there, Eamon McCann, journalist, 1974 book just republished, War in an Irish Town, May Read Farrell, Sinn Féin lawmaker in the Irish Parliament. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Kaiser Pride Fair is canceled over safety concerns. Alabama's ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth takes effect, and the Biden administration announces a program offering discounted internet service for low-income households. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 9th, 2022. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. I'm Althea Billings. The 2022 Kaiser Pride Fair has been canceled over safety concerns. The organizer, Claire Snyder, said she and her children have faced threats and doxing from anti-LGBT groups. Snyder put together the first community pride event in 2021 with about 3 weeks' notice. Hundreds gathered at Chalmers Jones Park to celebrate LGBTQIA+ inclusion. The event included information for families interested in fostering youth who may not be supported by their own families or communities. However, a group from Southern Oregon came to last year's events with signs condemning LGBTQ+ people. The hateful language was met by community pushback, and Kaiser police officers arrived to move demonstrators away from the Pride event. Snyder then began receiving even worse messages online. Snyder told city council members that she received, quote, personal threats against me and my children. Kaiser Mayor Kathy Clark and other members of the city council condemned such attacks and voiced support for the Pride Fair. However, Snyder has grown increasingly uneasy over the last few months as the threats have increased. Snyder says the city has not done enough to push back against anti-LGBTQ+ and racist presenters coming to the Salem-Kaiser area, including some speakers with the Reawaken America tour last month. In a post online, Snyder noted that groups known for exclusionary speech had attended the mayor's prayer breakfast. Snyder says this shows that the city has not taken sufficient action against hate speech. The Pride Fair for 2022 was ultimately canceled out of fear that LGBTQ opponents were more emboldened this year to retaliate. Snyder added, quote, "Think of something you're born with, you appreciate about yourself, and imagine someone flying a flag outside their door that says, 'Blue eyes suck, and if you don't want to see my flag, stay in your house.' You can't change your blue eyes. You can't just walk outside your house and ignore what's in your face. All I'm asking is to be seen as a human, for my children to be seen as human beings that exist here and deserve to celebrate their life and who they are." Portland police arrested a freelance journalist over the weekend who was a suspect in a string of arson and vandalism cases at two synagogues and a mosque in Portland. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Police announced Saturday that they had arrested a suspect believed to be involved in recent crimes committed at three religious sites in Portland. Michael E. Bivens, 34, was booked into the Multnomah County Jail Saturday morning. Bivens is accused of the following charges: first-degree criminal mischief for allegedly breaking a window at Congregation Shir Tikva in Northeast Portland on April 30th, third-degree criminal mischief for allegedly painting anti-Semitic graffiti at Congregation Beth Israel in Northwest Portland on May 2nd, first-degree criminal mischief for allegedly returning to Congregation Beth Israel on May 4th and breaking another window, and first-degree arson for allegedly lighting a fire at the Muslim Community Center of Portland. It was occupied at the time. The latter is considered a Measure 11 offense, which carries mandatory prison time if Bivens is convicted. He was arrested after he went to the KPTV television news station in Beaverton and demanded to speak with a reporter. He went to the station Wednesday and allegedly spoke with staff about his anti-Semitic views. Bivens was said to be carrying an ice pick and a hammer at the time. Bivens is a former freelance journalist who has reported extensively on right-wing protests and rallies. He covered street brawls and political polarization for Willamette Week for about 2 years. He has also expressed hateful views on his Twitter account. A Beaverton police detective coordinated with the TV station, and Bivens was taken into custody. Additional charges may still be filed against him. Portland law enforcement plans further discussion with federal authorities. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
The Biden administration announced on Monday that 20 internet companies have agreed to provide discounted service to U.S. households with low incomes. The program could effectively make tens of millions of households eligible for free service through an already existing federal subsidy. The $1 trillion infrastructure package passed by Congress last year included $14 billion for the Affordable Connectivity Program, which provides $30 monthly subsidies on internet services for millions of low-income households. The program also provides $75 monthly subsidies in tribal areas. With the new commitment from internet providers, around 48 million households will be eligible for $40 monthly plans for 100 megabits per second or higher speed service, making internet service fully paid for with the government subsidy if households sign up with one of the providers participating in the program. The 20 internet companies that have agreed to lower their rates for eligible consumers provide service in areas where 80% of the U.S. population lives, including 50% of the rural population. American households are eligible for subsidies through the Affordable Connectivity Program if their income is at or below 200% of the federal poverty level, or if a member of their family participates in one of several programs, including Supplementary Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, Federal Public Housing Assistance, and Veterans Pension and Survivors Benefit. Biden has repeatedly spoken about how low-income families have struggled to find reliable Wi-Fi, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic when many children needed Wi-Fi to take part in remote schooling and complete homework assignments. Biden said last month at a White House event honoring the National Teacher of the Year, quote, "If we didn't know it before, we know now. High-speed internet is essential." Russian President Vladimir Putin sought to justify his war in Ukraine on Monday, blaming Western countries and linking the conflict to World War II. In a speech at Moscow's Victory Day parade to celebrate the Soviet Union's triumph over Nazi Germany, Putin framed the struggling military campaign as a continuation of that historic fight. The Russian leader cast his invasion as a forced intervention to ward off aggression from the U.S. and NATO, repeating his false claim that Ukraine is run by Nazis controlled by the West. But while Putin repeated his familiar accusations against Moscow's rivals, he offered no sign of imminent escalation. Strong Ukrainian resistance and increasing military support from Kiev's allies, as well as Russian forces' failures, have left Putin with little to show for the war after more than 2 months of fighting. Putin made no reference to Mariupol, the crucial southern port city where a last pocket of Ukrainian resistance holed up in the ruins of the Azovstal steel plant has defied Russian efforts to seize complete control of the city. In Kiev, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky marked his people's sacrifice in the joint Soviet and Allied struggle against Nazi Germany in an emotional video, walking along an empty street with anti-tank barriers in his country's capital. Zelensky said Moscow hoped that Ukraine would refuse to celebrate the joint victory on May 9th amid the Russian invasion, but he said, quote, "We will not give anyone a piece of our history." Zelensky added, quote, "Soon Ukraine will have two victory days, and someone will have none left. We won then, we will now. End quote. According to new data from the government watchdog Accountable US, Exxon and Chevron raked in more than $12 billion in profits during the first 3 months of 2022. Researchers found that instead of stabilizing rising gasoline prices for American consumers, companies are using profits for stock buybacks and dividends for shareholders. Eric Galatis has more.
As millions of Americans are struggling to fill their gas tanks, a new report shows that rising prices are padding the bottom lines of powerful oil and gas companies. Exxon and Chevron alone brought in more than $12 billion in profits during the first quarter of 2022, more than $7 billion more than the same period a year ago. Carl Frisch with the group Accountable.us says the industry is taking advantage of converging global crises, including the war in Ukraine and pandemic-related inflation.
And rather than spending those billions of dollars in additional profits to help stabilize prices for consumers, they are showering those profits on their already wealthy executives.
Industry groups have argued that after suffering years of low oil prices due to overproduction and a drop in demand during the pandemic, stronger than projected revenues are helping companies get back on track. Others have noted that the drive for high quarterly returns is business as usual for publicly traded companies with a fiduciary obligation to maximize profits. Frisch says it's disingenuous for highly profitable companies to point to leaner years as a reason to waste profits that could be put to much better use. He says these companies never lose.
When big oil loses money, we bail them out. When big oil makes money, they just make money and they do nothing to help consumers. You're talking about an industry that took billions of dollars in Paycheck Protection Program funds from taxpayers during the height of the pandemic.
Frisch argues the industry is wasting an opportunity to invest in energy strategies that can better withstand shocks to the global economy, shocks that are only projected to increase as the impacts of climate change grow.
The best way to limit the impact on consumers is to start shifting away from these sources of fuels. And that is something that the oil and gas industry already invests in, and they could invest in it even more.
This is Eric Galatis reporting.
An Alabama law that makes it a felony to provide gender-affirming medical care to transgender youth went into effect on Sunday. This comes as a federal judge weighs whether to grant a motion to put a temporary hold on the law. The legislation makes it a crime punishable by up to 10 years in prison to provide puberty blockers, hormones, and medical procedures to transgender youth under the age of 19. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey signed the bill on April 8th. After a two-day hearing that concluded on Friday, U.S. District Judge Lillies Burke gave no indication on when he will rule on the motion seeking to temporarily halt the enforcement of the ban while a lawsuit is pending. The lawsuit is brought by organizations including the Human Rights Campaign and GLBTQ legal advocates and defenders. They argue the ban would cause immediate and irreparable harm to the plaintiffs, and that the measure violates several of their constitutional rights. The groups filed the lawsuit on behalf of parents of four Alabama transgender youth, two physicians, and a minister. The U.S. Department of Justice joined the case, saying the Alabama law violates the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment. A similar but not as far-reaching law in Arkansas was blocked by the courts last year before it could go into effect. Mainstream medical and mental health professionals say gender-affirming care saves lives by reducing the already high risk of depression and suicide among trans youth. According to medical experts, gender-affirming surgery for people under 18 is extremely rare and would take place only after years of treatment in cases where the patient's wishes are unwavering. Republican lawmakers have introduced hundreds of bills across state legislatures, with many of them directed at trans youth. Some Republican and conservative activists promote the laws as safeguards for children and parental rights. Opponents, including Democrats and LGBTQ organizations, say the legislation is harmful, unnecessary, and would have dire consequences on an already vulnerable population. You're listening to a spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for in-depth interviews with the Democratic candidates for Oregon House District 35 with Don Merrill. At 6, it's Labor Radio, then at 6:30, Prison Pipeline. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 41 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 61. Today in history, in 1960, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approves the world's first commercially produced birth control pill, granting greater reproductive freedom to American women. The development of the pill, as it became popularly known, was initially commissioned by birth control pioneer Margaret Sanger and funded by heiress Catherine McCormick. Sanger hoped to encourage the development of a more practical and effective alternative to the contraceptives that were in use at the time. The quote of the day is from American reproductive rights activist and president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America, Faye Waddleton. Waddleton said, quote, "Reproductive freedom is critical to a whole range of issues. If we can't take charge of this most personal aspect of our lives, we can't take care of anything. It should not be seen as a privilege or as a benefit, but a fundamental human right." A San Francisco judge tossed out former President Donald Trump's lawsuit challenging his permanent ban from Twitter. U.S. District Judge James Donato said Friday that Trump failed to show Twitter violated his First Amendment right to free speech. Free speech rights do not apply to private companies, and the judge wrote that Trump failed to show Twitter was working as a state actor on behalf of the Democrats. Trump sued Twitter, Facebook, and Google's YouTube in July of 2021, claiming they illegally censored him. All three platforms suspended Trump after the January 6, 2021 insurrection, in which his followers violently stormed the Capitol building in an attempt to block Congress from certifying Joe Biden's presidential win. The company cited concerns that Trump would incite further violence if allowed to stay on the platforms. The ruling comes as Elon Musk is in the process of purchasing Twitter for $44 billion. The deal has raised questions about whether Musk would allow the former president back on the platform. Trump has started his own social network, Truth Social, and said last week that he would not rejoin Twitter if given the chance. The suit had hoped to reinstate Trump's account, which had roughly 89 million followers, and those of five others who claimed they were also censored by Twitter. The group sought unspecified damages and class action status on behalf of others removed from the platform. Legal experts had predicted the lawsuit would fail, but suggested Trump would milk it for political purposes. Trump's political action committee immediately began raising money after the lawsuit was announced last year. Amazon's union head testifies in a Senate hearing. Congress will hold a vote to codify Roe v. Wade in the wake of the Supreme Court's draft opinion, and the Department of Justice creates an office to advance environmental justice. With more on these stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. Pro-choice activists protested Saturday outside the homes of Supreme Court Justices Brett Kavanaugh and John Roberts. Last week, an unprecedented leak of a draft opinion signaled the court is likely to overturn Roe v. Wade. A new CBS poll finds nearly two-thirds of Americans believe the court should uphold Roe, while more than four out of five believe overturning it would endanger women. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi yesterday called the leaked draft disrespectful.
And here we are on Mother's Day, a week where the court has slapped women in the face in terms of disrespect for their judgment about the size and timing of their families.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says in a few days he'll bring to the floor legislation to codify abortion rights into law. But even if the bill could get majorities in the Senate and House, it's very unlikely to overcome a filibuster. First Lady Jill Biden made a surprise visit to Ukraine Sunday, where she visited a school classroom and met with the country's First Lady, Olena Zelenska.
So I just wanted to come in and say Happy Mother's Day and say that the hearts of the American people are with the mothers of Ukraine.
A Russian bomb that hit a school turned shelter over the weekend may have killed 60. And the White House says new sanctions will bar Russian companies and citizens from using U.S. business services. Experts say the coronavirus continues to mutate, and a new Omicron variant could become the dominant strain here in weeks. There's no evidence it causes more severe disease, but Dr. Abrar Karan with the Stanford School of Medicine says the U.S. is not prepared.
We can't develop, you know, new vaccines fast enough to get us out of a surge. So if we're hit with another surge quickly, revaccinating the whole population of countries takes time, and we will be hit so hard once again.
Average daily COVID-19 hospitalizations are up about 10% since last week, according to federal figures. A U.S. grand jury on Saturday indicted 62-year-old Frank James on terrorism and other charges, stemming from a New York subway attack last month. James is accused of planting smoke bombs and opening fire inside a subway car in Brooklyn, injuring 32 and setting off a national manhunt. And in Florida, a federal appeals court has temporarily reinstated a law limiting third-party voter registration, ballot drop boxes, and bringing food or water to people waiting in line at the polls. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Lawyers in Canada representing survivors of the 1960s Scoop class action lawsuit are requesting court approval to provide a final payment to those who signed on to the case, and dozens of people walked across Browning, Montana last week to raise awareness for missing and murdered Indigenous people. With these stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Lawyers in Canada representing survivors of the 1960 Scoop class action lawsuit are requesting court approval to provide a final payment to those who signed on to the case. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, some survivors are calling it a slap in the face.
The so-called 60s Scoop was controversial. Indigenous children were taken from their communities and cultures and placed into foster care with non-Indigenous families, often far from their home communities. Many were abused. A class action lawsuit argued that those affected by the program suffered significant harm, specifically the loss of their cultural identity. A settlement was reached a couple of years ago in which the government in Ottawa set aside $750 million to compensate First Nations and Inuit children who were subjected to the Scoop between 1951 and 1991. By January of last year, nearly 15,000 claims were approved, including interim payments of $21,000 to each claimant. Lawyers are now asking for an additional $4,000 each. But some survivors, like Colleen Rajot, say there is no way the current compensation is acceptable.
We're not going to sit by and watch rich lawyers get even richer, and we're going to walk away with barely anything.
Another Scoop survivor is Brenda Lee Marcoux from British Columbia.
There's no amount of money they could give us that would give us back what we've lost. To lose your family, to lose your language, to lose your culture, to lose everything. Everything. You can't pay me back for that.
She and others call the $25,000 an insult, adding that it feels more like abuse, something that's never going to end. Some want more than compensation, an apology, and for those responsible to be held accountable. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Dozens of people walked across Browning, Montana last week to raise awareness for missing and murdered Indigenous people. Aaron Bolton reports the walk comes as the college on the Blackfeet Reservation is launching a database to help resolve unsolved cases.
Dozens of Blackfeet Nation residents whose loved ones were murdered or are missing walked across Browning as a drum circle played. Rhonda Grant Connolly's nephew, Matthew Rattlesnake Grant, was found dead in 2016.
Our family would leave the comfort of their warm homes to search in blizzard conditions. We searched for our nephew for 2 weeks without help from the Blackfeet PD Sheriff Department.
Wilma Fleury shares the frustration that cases fall through the cracks due to jurisdictional issues between tribal, county, and federal law enforcement. She says the people who murdered her son, Willie Pepian, won't be brought to justice.
I never got justice on my boy. They dropped the federal charges against the people that did it because not enough evidence. But So they turn it over to tribal. All tribal could do misdemeanors.
A new database could help families connect with law enforcement agencies more quickly after a loved one goes missing. Blackfeet Community College Extension agent Drew Landry says families can log on to MMIPMT.com and report a missing person, including their last known location, anywhere in Montana.
If we get a report of a missing person, it's also carbon copied to tribal police, and we are working on having all the tribal nations on board by the end of this summer.
Landry says the site will even help connect families with law enforcement off reservations or even in other states. He hopes to have a report later this year on how many cases reported into the database have been solved. For National Native News, I'm Aaron Bolton.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Volunteer pilots are rescuing sea turtles stunned by cold water. Cold stunning is a growing problem as the climate changes. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Hundreds of volunteer pilots across the U.S. have offered their time and planes to fly rescue missions for sea turtles in need of help.
We are all about taking care of these endangered species.
Leslie Weinstein is president of Turtles Fly 2. The nonprofit coordinates emergency flights for sea turtles that wash up on the shores of Cape Cod and elsewhere, suffering from cold stunning. It's a reaction the animals can experience in waters below about 50 degrees Fahrenheit.
They become lethargic. It starts to shut down their organs.
And they can die without medical care. So when stranded turtles are found, Weinstein's group can be called in to help fly them to rehabilitation centers in the southeast. Weinstein says over the years, his group has gotten busier.
We're getting larger numbers of them becoming cold stunned.
And climate change may be partly to blame. Research suggests that as the ocean warms, some turtles are spending more time farther north in the summer and fall. Then, when winter temperatures arrive, they may end up stuck in waters colder than they can handle. So the need for rescue flights is growing, and Weinstein and other volunteers are ready to help. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to a spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 9th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Don Merrill. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Galatis, Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Ramlagan, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Times Like Now with host Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Galavan interviews Barbara Mumbi Huerta, the Vice President of Programs and Partnerships at the Center for Native Arts and Culture in Portland, about the group show by local Native American artists called Where the Waters Come Together. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. We are in our spring membership hive drive now, and it's a great time to support us. If you'd like to become a member and support community radio, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We'll be hearing from the Democratic candidates for House District 35.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Oregon voters will have until next Tuesday, May 17th, to turn in their primary ballots by mail or at a local drop box. Today, we'll be hearing interviews with the Democratic candidates for Oregon House District 35. This district includes a chunk of Southwest Portland, the Portland Community College Sylvania campus, and most of Tigard. First, we'll be hearing an excerpt of Don Merrill's interview with candidate Farah Chaichi.
I'm Don Merrill, and I'm talking with Farah Chaichi. Ms. Chaichi is a challenger for Oregon House seat in District 35. Ms. Chaichi, welcome.
Thank you.
Ms. Chaichi, my first question for you, ma'am, is why are you running for Oregon's 35th House District seat?
Well, I am running on a human rights platform. I want to help get transformative legislation passed to protect vital human rights for every Oregonian. And if being in the state legislature is how I can help make that happen, then that's where I want to be. I've been an activist for a while. I've been involved in local politics since 2014. And a lot of people might think that this is a natural progression for me, but honestly, I hadn't seen that coming. But I want voices like mine and experiences like mine reflected in Salem. And last year, at the end of the year, my friend, Representative Winsbey Campos, approached me and asked me to consider running for the House seat because she thought I would do a good job representing our community and we share the same values. I had to think about it for a while, though, because I'm sure you can imagine this is a lot of work, but also, unfortunately, last year, we lost my mom to COVID, and every plan that I had, because I had maybe been thinking about city council, sort of went on the back burner, you know?